All right, we're live. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Unite's podcast. We got the two most important figures of Unite, Mike, the national director, who's been here before, and we got a special guest, Jerry, today. Jerry, what's your position at Unite?
I'm national secretary of Unite Union, so I'm overall responsibility of the overall union.
Yes, so it's very nice of you to join us. Jared isn't someone that can join us often because he lives in...
In beautiful rural Manawatu in the lower North Island.
Normally. So we can only have him when he's up in Auckland.
I'm very happy to be here.
So today's topic, we're a bit off topic. We were supposed to do health and safety, but John has been called away last minute, so we have to switch to a later on topic, and today's topic is actually called the hours of work. Those that is familiar with Unite will know that we've campaigned a lot on this a few years ago. We even made international headlines for hours of work, and that's the zero-hour contract. You'll see it in the intro somewhere of us mass protesting, but we thought we won the battle of hours of work, but unfortunately with what's happening with COVID, we are seeing it coming back in a, it's like the coronavirus, it's mutated, isn't it?
Yes.
A different form of it. So Jared and Mike, we're just going to have a chat about, you know, what is the hours of work so important, and what is the future looking like?
Well, just to start with is that we started on hours of work. Wages is always a focus of workers. But in the fast food industry particularly, but generally in hospitality and lots of other areas, the hours of work, you know, whether you get an extra 50 cents or $1 an hour extra will make a difference. But whether you get 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week or 35 makes a huge difference.
For sure.
And so that's what we looked at. And while many people got some often reasonably regularly, you know, 25, 30, 35 hours, often that was completely at the manager's discretion, hence the 0 hours. Literally, you had no ability, the managers and the company had the ability. And while it was also about income, crucially what it was also about, and this remains very important, it's about power and control. Because if you can, your manager has the power to just pull away your hours from one week to the other. That gives them enormous power and control over you. And so that was a big factor as well. So we fought the campaign to get guaranteed hours. That had been a focus. We tried different ways, bargaining and so on. But in the end, we just know you've got to have some guaranteed hours. And that led to a law change in the end. It was a very successful campaign. That's internationally relevant, as you've said. It's a struggle that goes on. And we've had, you know, we had quite a bit of success within our employers, for those who didn't have it, across the fast foods. And the law change did make some difference, but unfortunately, particularly in hospitality and other areas, it's honoured only in technically. For instance, it's very common for people to have 3 hours, guaranteed hours, which they have to have, but actually be working 20 or 30 hours. Although technically those workers don't have to show up for those hours, but there's all sorts of other ways employers can make them. They have to eat for a start, they have to pay the rent, so that forces people. So, but it has made a change. You know, it's crucially important. And as you said, though, the problem with under what's happening now is where you've got redundancies and reductions of hours. What should happen is if there's reductions in hours, that's fine. You know, if that has to happen, that has to happen. And then as the hours increase, the guaranteed hours should increase again. But what we fear and what we think will be happening is a lot of those hours, they won't be increased as guaranteed hours. They'll be put back as casualised hours. The workforce will be casualised.
So am I allowed to talk about my ex-employer?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to name and shame them? So I used to work with Sports Guy City, and when I initially got hired, I wasn't actually hired on a zero-hour contract, but it wasn't that much better off. No. I was hired as an eight-hour part-time contract, and we thought this is actually how I got involved with the union because of the 0 hours. And when we did an average calculation, in 2016 alone, I was working an average of 55 hours.
Yeah.
2015 or 2014, that average was even higher, but my guarantee was 8.
Yeah.
What that means was a lot of us, and it was about, I want to say about 300 of us part-time workers on an 8-hour contract, for all of us working up to 40 hours or even more.
Yeah.
And what it create was a lot of fear. So you ended up doing any shift that you That's can right. get your hands on. It's thinking about it. It's almost slavery, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, when we're doing the 0-hour stuff, it was the comparison you'd used was the sort of images from the 1930s where the truck would go down to the wharf and unemployed men, it was, they would be standing there, hop on the back of the truck, who wants to work? That was your negotiation, that was your employment agreement. You know, you get a day's work, health and safety, you know, it was non-existent, and then that's the end of the day. You know, it was literally that. Your relationship was almost in the day by day. The power was all one way. So, yeah, that was right. And even though, and we have improved things, we've got bans, but what I think we've found is that even if, what I talked about before, even if workers can actually, there is a way that can individually go through and improve their hours or refuse to work, that's very difficult for them to do in practice. And what we need to improve it is actually make sure there's a link between your actual hours worked and...
Yeah, so sorry about that. We had a bit of a technical difficulties where the phone stopped recording. So, Jared, you were saying about, you know...
Yeah, so even though workers... You know, even at Sky City, where you, the example you were using, where you could apply for bans and you could review it, even we'll put that in place where there is a process individually that you can go through to increase your hours, even though workers who have only very minimum guaranteed hours, if they could say, I'm only going to work my guaranteed hours, I'm not going to work, in practice that's very difficult for them to do that. So we actually need a change in the law, a change in the process that that links your actual hours work to your guaranteed hours. You can't get the situation you're talking about where you're guaranteed 8, but working 40, 50 hours a week. That's ridiculous. And there should be some process. We need to improve the law, keep going, so that there is some link. And that's what we've been doing since that with our own agreements. You know, and so Mike was involved in McDonald's this year, so we've got made some progress on that. So
yeah, about that. Yeah, that's quite an important change to the McDonald's agreement. So because the virus had struck before the contract negotiations had finished, we shifted tack from our original plan to one which would allow workers to improve their guaranteed hours number over time. Because McDonald's, we felt, had done, whilst we'd got rid of zero-hour contracts and everyone had guaranteed hours, often, especially for new staff, they would only give them a small number of guaranteed hours, and that would never get reviewed. So in these negotiations, the company accepted there was a problem and we put in a mechanism to fix it so that every time a worker leaves, that the hours that that worker was working are offered to existing staff before new staff are hired. And that will, and they have an app now in which a lot of this stuff happens, rostering and so on. So it's an automatic process, not dependent on a manager's discretion. So the hours are, the hours of the worker who's leaving are known. They are offered. Workers can agree to take up those hours, and they can agree to change their own working times to suit the new hours as part of that process. That should, over time, allow workers to match their preferred working time to their guaranteed working time, I think. And workers will be able to monitor it by another clause we put into the agreement, which is that the roster is on the wall so people can see, you know, who's working what hours and have a way of monitoring things when people leave, themselves as well as us as a union being able to monitor it. Well, I think that's a very important victory in this year's negotiations, and very pleased to be able to achieve. It's just something we've been trying to achieve right from the very beginning, in a sense. We've always had clauses along those lines, but we just never had the mechanism for monitoring and enforcing it.
So I guess the other way that workers can actually assure that their hours is guaranteed is also by education, because a lot of young workers, and this is the issue I see we face as a union, because majority of our members is actually under the age of 35, and I think about 40%, I want to say 40% of our members is actually under the age of 30, and for a lot of them it's their first job, and they might not know this. So talking to your peers and watching this podcast.
Well, yeah, and just because there is a lot of deception involved, though, in these things. So what will happen is commonly you'll find that workers are told that when they get the job, you know, which your bargaining power isn't that high, particularly in times of high unemployment, but they're told anyway that they'll get 20, 30 hours, and they won't be given 20 to 30 hours, but what they sign on the dotted line, unless they go through the 15 pages and actually make sure, you know, what they'll find is that their guaranteed hours are 3 or 8 or 10, and they don't realise the significance of that number. So there's a lot of deliberate deception on their part, and so what they'll find is they'll be merely going along, not realising, and then a few months later or a year later even, suddenly bang, and they go, well, hold on, you told me. So we'll look at your contract, it only says 8 hours. So there's a lot of ways to push back on that. A lot of companies have been, what they've been slowly is doing this, is hiring workers on lower and lower guaranteed hours, so we have to push back on that. And the reason why companies do, because it's quite important, and I think this is crucial, this is why it was so important to us. It's important for the workers, because obviously your rent doesn't go up and down depending on what the demand at McDonald's or, you know, Sky City is. Your rent is your rent, your food's your food. So it's actually quite important. And the companies push back by saying, well, they like the flexibility. Well, some people like the flexibility, but actually that's the company wants the flexibility, actually. Some workers don't want to work full-time. But, of course, when we talk about unemployment, the biggest and the most accurate measure of unemployment is not who has a job and who doesn't. It's who is how many hours are people working, how many hours do they want to work. So unemployment, you know, is tipped to rise to, you know, maybe around 10%. Underemployment, the number of people who would like more work but can't get it, will be massive. It'll be up to a third or more in this country. And that's the real problem, is we've got a whole lot of unemployment that's hidden. It's not actually hidden. There is a measure, and that's actually the measure we should talk about and use as the demand for jobs.
So I guess that brings them to today's topic and links with what's happening globally is that in the past 3-4 weeks, I don't count how many weeks we've been doing this, is that we've been seeing a lot of restructures is happening in these companies. Today is Sky City's last day.
Yeah.
They're going to have, 500 to 700 people that's going to be unemployed as of 5 o'clock today.
Yeah.
And that's a scary thought because that's a big company that employs, they claim up to 3,000 employees. That's a lot of people that's going to be unemployed. So I guess what is the problem you see us facing with these mass unemployments?
Well, what it was is, like Sky City is a good example. They will recover, maybe not to where they were, but they will recover. But it will take a couple of years, given the tourism. So what will happen, we've got a whole lot of workers who've lost their job altogether. And then slowly demand will pick up again, right? Now what should happen is the first thing is the existing workers there who had their hours cut back a while work should get given more work. That's the first thing that should happen.
But it should be guaranteed.
Yes, but there's no guarantee that they will even be offered those hours for a start. So that's the first thing. The danger is that there will be a whole lot of new part-time people with very low minimum guarantees. The second thing is that new people employed shouldn't be employed for, like, 3 people on 8 hours, minimum 8 hours. It should be 1 person on minimum 24 hours with the option of going to 40 hours. That's what should happen. So that's what is likely to end up with a whole lot of more new workers on very minimum guaranteed hours or no guaranteed hours, casualised, because what you've got, you see, you create a pool of people who are fighting for the hours. Mm-hmm. It's like the guy down at the wharf, you know? How do you get the wages down? Well, there's 40 of you. I've only got 10 jobs. So, yeah, you made trouble yesterday. You complained that you didn't have any health and safety, so you're not getting a job. And you complained that your wages went high. Well, you're not getting a job. So it's the same thing. What happens? You've got a pool of workers. They're all desperate for hours, and that can be used to control, keep wages, suppress wages, keep people from making any complaints about anything at all or improving their wages and conditions. So that's the fear of what will happen. And that's really important. And the power and control is one thing, but the other thing is, why this is such an important issue is, for any business, almost any business, your labour costs are around, you know, 70% is typical, 80, sometimes go to 80%. So your labour costs are 80%. The deal used to be this, an old style 1950s, 60s capitalism was this, 70s, was that you turn up for work, they employ you for 40 hours or 20, whatever it is, all right, and you get paid no matter what. The only situation you wouldn't get paid is if the whole thing goes bust and it's made redundant.
So the risk is
on with the employer. That's right. It's called capitalism. You know, the reason why they say they take all the profits and they get more money is because they take the risk. That's okay. We can argue about that, and then people have for
centuries. We'll have another session on capitalism.
That's right. But, okay, at least there's some logic to that. Mm-hmm. What happened in the 80s and 90s, right, is that risk got turned to the workers in those industries, right? Because if you've got a tap which you can turn on and off anytime you like, you can literally turn the tap on and off. 70% of your costs, I mean, there's no risk to it. If demand goes down, you just turn the tap off. The risk is with the worker. The lower, these low-paid, casualised workers are actually taking the risk. Okay, you know, and the extreme example, because it's somewhere good to look at extremes. The really someone in the US, they didn't implement it, but they came up with the idea. They're taking it to the extreme, right? And what they wanted to build a very flash, this is for a KFC, they wanted to build a very flash employee lounge. And they said they would have armchairs and PlayStations. Of course, it would have been a kitchen table, a couple of chairs and a Nintendo. You know, an old Nintendo, actually, we know. But anyway, the idea was you'd have this very flash lounge and you wouldn't clock in when you go to work. You'd be available. You'd have to be available in the lounge. And you'd clock in when a customer came in and they needed you, and you'd clock in, get paid, do your work, clock out again and go to the employee lounge, right? So they'd only pay you when they absolutely needed you. And we laugh. I'm telling you, if companies could get away with it, they would do that. Absolutely, they would do that. I mean, it's piecework. I mean, companies do it. They pay people on pizza. But that is the logic of it. And that tells you, because that's how that risk has been shifted. That would there's no risk. All they have to do is keep paying the rent and the power, you know, and there's almost, they've eliminated risk. If there's a bad day, you don't lose money because the employees lose the money. Mm. So that's why it's so important, and equally why it's so important for employees, because who can live like that?
Yeah.
It's not like your rent goes, oh, look, we didn't sell much chicken today, so your rent's hard. Well, it doesn't matter.
And as the employment grew in New Zealand through the 90s into the 2000s, and unemployment began dropping significantly, they opened the doors to temporary migrant labour to maintain that ability to just have people at their beck and call. So we sort of discover that in this crisis situation that we now have 300,000 workers in New Zealand. That's a significant percentage of the workforce who are on some form of temporary visa, and then we just toss them aside when they're no longer needed. And I think that that's a very inhuman thing to have done to that migrant workforce, and they need to be given some chance of income support, and those who have been regularly in New Zealand need to be able to transition to permanent residency as well, because we have kept people in an indefinite temporary situation and taken advantage of them, and it's okay in the good times, so-called, maybe, when this labour is desperately sort of needed and people are able to sort of renew their visas. But now we have a situation where people who have made their lives here are being told that they don't have any rights at all. I don't think that that's acceptable.
Well, that's actually on my list of stuff that we're going to talk about in the future. Hopefully we can invite someone from the Migrant Workers Association to talk about that issue. But I just want to rewind back a bit to casual workforce, because I'm hearing a lot of that word being thrown around, and it took me a few years to actually understand what is casualization, like the actual casual contract, and how it is actually, people don't realize is that their casual contract is probably very, very unlawful, and they could actually be on a variation of a zero-hour contract. Now, Mike and I, we did this negotiation back in, I think, 2017 for the Knowledge Warehouse. They are a telemarketer, they're not telemarketers, they're research people who make you fill out surveys, and on their papers, they're actually saying everyone is casuals, but when we actually did the homework, all of the people there were on a zero-hour contract. Now, we managed to do a little bit of movement on them to give them some type of guaranteed hours, but I don't think a lot of people, and these are people who've been union for, Susan was in the union since the 60s and the 70s, and you have people working there for 10 years and stuff, and they don't understand the difference. Can you guys just...
Often people are on what is called a casual contract, but... which says that, you know, we will offer you work when it's available and you can accept that work if you want to. And in theory, a casual agreement should be a daily offer of work and a daily acceptance of work. And they have a right not to offer and a right not to accept. However, that's in reality, workers are very often put onto a regular employment regime. And as soon as that happens, even if the written contract doesn't change, for example, if you are put onto a roster, you have become a regular employee, unless it's a specified short-term contract.
Wouldn't it be a fixed-term contract?
Yeah, if it was a fixed-term contract, that would be slightly different, but different rules around that. But there have been court cases where the courts have simply said that if you're on a roster, you're not a casual. That's effectively, and that's something to look out for. If you don't have a right to refuse the work, if you don't, for example, you're not a casual. If you and you can get the benefits that you should have got backdated to when as soon as you started to be put on the roster, for example. So you should have benefits of annual leave. If that's been paid to you weekly or, you know, daily, then the annual leave benefits can be backdated. I did a case for a worker at Sky City where they got... 8 years of he was on a casual contract allegedly, but worked every week for 8 years, and at least, you know, some hours every week for 8 years, and so the company had to pay 8 times 4, you know, 32 weeks of annual leave compensation for him.
That's, and I
even though he'd been paid the 8% on top.
Yeah. That's their problem for breaching the contract. But what we're actually seeing is, and this is happening in cinema, and I wish Hannah was actually here to talk about it, is that a lot of cinemas is going through, well, one major cinema chain is going through restructure. I'm not sure what's happening with the other one. And so they're making everyone redundant, but they're offering people casual contracts.
Yeah.
Can they do that?
Well, they could do it for a short term, but they have to be very careful. We have dealt with employees who have been caught out by this sort of situation, Mike. And then they go to put in place rules to make sure they go, all right, we don't want that to happen again. And you look at it, and it's actually very restrictive. You have to be very careful, if you have casual employees, because it doesn't take much, as Mike said, you know, a few things, doesn't take much for their pattern suddenly to make them actually permanent employees. So technically they could for a short period of time. But actually, if they return to any sense of normalcy, either they're going to be in the position where they're breaching the law, where they actually have got people who aren't casual, or they put themselves at risk of literally having no permanent staff. That any one day, people could go, don't feel like working today, that's okay. And in the case of the cinemas, there is a bit of that, we've got situations, but they still needed guaranteed hours. I mean, a lot of the cinema workers are happy to have some guaranteed hours and have that flexibility.
So they're not casual then? If you have guaranteed hours...
Absolutely. So if they can have casuals, they have no guaranteed hours, which means literally people don't have to show up from day to day, week to week. And it's very hard. You can have some workers like that,
But if you have a it'd be impossible to run any sort of business on a purely casual operation, because literally you don't know if anyone's going to show up that day. Who can run an organisation like that? I mean, there might be some, I don't know, but that's ridiculous.
Reynolds done it for years.
Yeah, well, you can't, because actually, because you're right, they actually say, well, actually, you have to show up for it. Well, you're not casual.
Yeah.
You're simply not casual. That's all there is to it. So there's a big risk there. But as we've seen, education is really important for workers who don't realise that's going on. But also, you know, it shouldn't be up to workers to have to figure out no employment law and no case law to know whether they're casual or not. That's the reality of it. And so it has to be very clear, and the penalties have to be such. Like paying the annual leave twice, people, you know, oh, well, that's not fair to the employers. You can see them bleeding. But actually, it's good, because we better make sure that doesn't happen again, because we do not want to be paying 8% extra wages. In Australia, if you're on a casual contract, there are loadings, right? You get 20-25% extra, because there's so many disadvantages to being on a casual agreement. And even that's, you know, even they estimate that often those loadings don't actually compensate you for everything you lose under those type of contracts.
So I guess, you know, that's something we will definitely need to watch out for, and workers, just be careful if you are being offered a casual contract in this post-COVID society.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we can call it post-COVID at the moment. But,
the key message for workers is this. Guaranteed hours are these. Okay, if you're casual contract, you haven't got any guaranteed hours. So let's be very aware of that. Well, that means that your employer doesn't have to give you the hours, but you don't have to work them either. And for any kind of agreement, that goes too. If you've got guaranteed hours, that means your employer has to offer them to you, and you have to agree to work those guaranteed hours, right? But anything that's not guaranteed, you don't have to work. So that's a bit of power that workers have under the legislation we fought for. So if you're actually working 30 hours and your employer is only guaranteed you 8, and he wants, and you might want to wait till you want to take some time off, and they say, oh, no, you can't have leave. Well, what you can do is say, well, actually, I only have to work 8 hours this week. I don't have to work the other 20, so I will take it off, and then they start. And then you can go, if you want me to work 30 hours, then you guarantee them. That's the power.
But that's the thing. It's, you know, it's all good in practice and stuff when we talk about this, but a lot of workers are afraid to tell the managers. Now, you're my boss. I can tell you, if you ask me to work, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I can tell you, no, Jared, I'm going to sleep. But not everyone is in the position that we're in that can tell their managers, I'm not going to work, I'm only guaranteed 8. Now, I'm for someone who's actually suffered the consequences of that by telling my manager, no, I'm not going to work. What can workers do? I guess the first question is, what can't an employer do if it's outside of my guaranteed hours?
They can't make you work. They can't force you to work.
Can they discipline you?
No, they can't discipline you.
And they definitely can't fire you.
They definitely can't fire you. You have to show up. You have to do your guaranteed hours, because that's the only obligation they have to you. So that's the power. Don't be bullied or intimidated. If you feel your guaranteed hours are too low, right, then the easiest way is to have a conversation with your employer, say, look, these are too low. I'm actually working more and more hours. You know, I simply won't, I don't want to work those hours, or you don't even say I'm not going to work. You say, look, I know that I might not be available for those hours. So if you want me to be available for all those hours, you need to guarantee that. It's as simple as that. That's the conversation. You don't even have to not to work them. Simply point out to the employer that you're aware of your rights.
But here's the other side to it, and Sky City has made this argument to me, and quite a few other companies made this over the years, is that, oh, this is just a short boom. Like, this is Christmas, and all of a sudden we have all these people coming in. What can you do then? Because you know, between the quiet period, you are still working a significant amount of hours.
Yeah. Well, that's it may, in some industries, like boom, bust, although I'm on the advisory group for the tourism industry and hospitality industry, and you know, there's been a lot of discussion, and there'll be more discussion now, because they're frustrated about the quality of workers, the turnover. And my point was, of course, yes, because you're offering a lot of hours at one time of the year, and then you sack them all, and you know, or you reduce their hours, because they get plenty of skilled, you know, smart people through.
The problem is not that they haven't got the people coming in. The problem is they can't keep them because people go, well, actually, I need a job. I need a job.
For sure.
Pays is 52 weeks a job. So I think actually they are now thinking about it. I think the tourism industry and the horticulture, you know, they're all thinking about it now is, yeah, this is a real problem, particularly what the tap to the cheap overseas labour might be turned up, which is a big factor in horticulture and in tourism particularly. It's okay. If we are going to have to convince we don't have that cheap labour, easy, pliable labour from migrant workers, okay, how are we going to get Kiwis to take these jobs? How are we going to get people, permanent residents, to take these jobs? And the big thing is not so much the wages, but it's that secured hours right thing. So they're going to have to think. I think that's what's going to have to happen. Think about how can we create a job? And some of them are coming up with ideas because they always talk about training and skills. And I said, well, in the downtime, training workers, you know, that's the obvious one. And the government, you know, there's lots of support now for extra training. So I think that's where the government can come in too. How do we create real jobs, right, that are more productive, because that's the other thing, we have to raise our productivity. So there's some opportunities there to create real jobs. Think about how we can, rather than having boom bust, how can we smooth that out? And I think that's going to happen anyway, let's face
it. So all the training now, all the training for apprenticeships and skills up in all of the sectors that are we're going to require labour is all going to be free for those who are doing it. But in addition, employers are being massively subsidised,
yes,
to take on these trainees. So there's going to be a $16,000 available over the first 2 years of an apprenticeship's engagement. And so there's almost no risk now to employers to do the training that's required, and they should be encouraged and forced to, if needs be.
And that's a good example, because traditionally what you do, you'd have your apprenticeship and they'd be working 3 days and they'd be training the other 2 days. Or we could restructure it so that they're working 5 days during the busy time and they're studying full-time during the downtime. You know, that we, you know, there's lots of ways we can do that, but that's the challenge. And what's good is, I think, the employers, or the more savvy ones, are figuring out they can't keep on doing what they're doing.
Unfortunately, not all the employers.
No, but as I said, you know, the cheap labour tap is going to be turned off. The minimum wage is going up. They complain about the minimum wage going up. Well, actually, it's not a problem if productivity goes up too. But to get productivity, you need training, you need commitment, you need experienced and skilled workers. This turnover, this casualisation, actually has a tremendously corrosive effect on productivity.
Sure.
Every time you get a new worker, every time you have a worker who's not committed, you know, who's, you know, they won't invest in training.
Monkeys.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, just a bit wearing on the time, we're cutting a bit close to our time. Obviously, you know, there's a lot more that we can talk about. Firstly, I'm someone who doesn't understand how capitalists work. It makes no logical sense to me. But unfortunately, we still live in a capitalist society, and that's how a lot of employers think when it comes to hiring and offering jobs to workers. And like you said, the whole risk factor, it's a very unbalanced risk that employees have to now take instead of employers. And one thing that, as a union organizer, and seeing this, is that workers need to be very careful out there during this post-COVID, is that you make sure that you have a guaranteed hours and you are not bullied into taking on additional work if you are not available for it.
Yeah, it's very important that when you start a job or when you agree to a change in the hours, that you, what's really important, you know, is don't listen to what they say. Read what they've written down and what you sign. Because even though technically what they tell you is a contract, to prove it is extremely difficult. Whereas what's written and what you've signed. So that's one message, absolutely. Read it. If you don't understand it, take some time, get someone else to read it, take advice on it. Because what you sign is actually what you're committing to. That's the first thing.
And also, I think the other thing is that worker needs to realise is that cheap market that Mike was talking about, that's cut off. A lot of people think this is a time where there's going to be not enough job and too many workers. But the reality is it still could be a balance if workers know what to look out for out there. Because at the end of the day, a company needs a worker for it to function, for it to go on. So your employers will need you to get the money.
Yeah.
The millions of dollars profit they
I think they're only going to realise is what Mike's talking about is in the end there's a pool of labour, right? And they want that to be as flexible as possible. So you've got migrant workers, you've got workers with unemployed workers, you've also got, crucially, the biggest pool of labour is actually workers who want more work, but aren't, you know, but have part-time jobs but haven't enough work. So this is all one big pool of labour, you know? And I think what we know about capitalism is that in the end, they'll try and figure out one way or another. So if the migrant worker, the less migrant workers available, what they'll be doing is how can we create a bigger pool internally? You know, so casualising is a way to do that. So previously you had a pool of labour which had some more guaranteed hours. If you lay them off and you replace them with casualised workers, then you've created a pool of labour. Yeah, that's not unusual for people who have 2-3 jobs.
Push along.
Yeah, so...
Look, just be careful out there in the post-COVID world. And we've got to end this podcast today. But I wouldn't mind coming back to this topic, maybe part of in the future if you guys like to hear this. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Thank you, Jared, for being here. We do have a few more topics. I'm going to thank Mike because he's here in the office all the time. We'll see more of him in our
thank
podcast.
You,
I will post up a few more topics on our Facebook and our other social medias of what we're going to be talking about in the podcast. Let me know what you guys want to hear first. We will try not to pre-record any topics. However, there may be some topics that will need to be pre-recorded. But we might put those on as a special edition or something.